It is, as ever, my great pleasure to welcome one of the founders of Many Rivers Books Antique, a man that many admire and revere, even, for good reason. He has been a teacher of Tayu meditation for something like close to 20 years at this point, and has been a practitioner for well over a quarter century at this point. But that is, of course, belied by his youthful and beautiful appearance.
He
started very early. He's here to tell us tonight about a new project that he's been working on, which is the Mystical Positivist Project. It started off as a blog and quickly evolved into a radio show on KOWS-LP, a radio station, community radio station in Occidental, broadcasting live on the web at KOWS.FM. And so Stuart is going to tell us what this project is about, what he's been doing with it, and what it can mean for spiritual practice. I'm looking forward to hearing about it.
Or maybe not.
Maybe we'll talk about something else.
Hey, thank you very much.
Welcome.
So let's begin first with a nod to one of the upcoming speakers that Rob was reading, talking about bringing grace from the head into the heart. Let's go a little step further and let's bring grace into the body. So before we begin, let's just bring our attention back into our body and just try to feel your body. You can begin to concentrate or bring your focus of attention to the point just below the navel and the kind of center of your abdomen. Areas known as the hara in some traditions. And from there, just feel your presence begin to expand. You can allow your attention to move into your hips. Feel your sense of presence in your thighs and your knees. Allow it to descend into your calves, into your ankles, and your feet and toes. And now bring your focus back to your abdomen and bring your presence of attention up into your chest. Just feel your torso. Feel your shoulder blades and your shoulders, and allow your presence of attention to flow into your arms, into your elbows, your forearms and your hands and fingers. Now allow your sense of presence to extend up your neck. Feel the base of your skull. Feel your face and head, the muscles of your face and head. And now allow yourself just to be aware of your presence in your entire body and just feel your body as a unity. It's not necessary to have any words or anything like that, but just allow your attention to rest on the sensation of being in your body. Now you can just bring your attention back to the room here. Note the distinction or the sense of difference that that exercise with all of us doing it together does to the room. It sort of quiets things down in a way. And certainly I can feel a calmness or a peacefulness in the energy. I had an interesting experience when we were interviewing Denise Berry Sensei. You know, if I look at the different interviews that we do with people, sometimes we have guests in the studio, sometimes we have guests on the phone, and the energy I bring to the interview will shift depending on how rushed I have been that week or how, you know, what's going on. But I remember distinctly when Denise was in the studio, and she's a Aikido sensei, and so she's practiced and taught Aikido for 20 or 30, 35 years, I think, something like that. The space had this quality to it, had this grounded quality. And it was interesting for me because I began to become aware, because I was so different from some of the other interviews, I began to pay attention to not only the quality of my voice in the interview space, but also the quality of the guest and, you know, the kind of energy that they brought. So I invited you to do this particular exercise because it is one of the foundational exercises that arises in the Fourth Way tradition for bringing ourselves back to ourselves. And we had actually a discussion about this very topic with one of our guests, a gentleman named Red Hawk, who is the author of the book Self-Observation There, a very good book. But he was one of our telephone guests, and a lot of what he talked about was related to bringing attention back to the body as a starting point for beginning to observe oneself. Because that's sort of the foundation, and that's sort of the base. So we wanted to start this evening there and build up from there. Another thing that arose for me to say, I'm not quite sure why, because it doesn't have as much to do with the talk now, but we've been reflecting on our current states of our lives, particularly in Tayu Center, all the members of the community have various levels of intensity going on for them. And for myself, I, about 9 months ago, started a new job in Redwood City that's very demanding and requires that I travel to the home office in Israel quite a bit. So I've got cultural issues, I've got technology issues, I've got being away from home issues, and all these sorts of things are just factors to focus on. Rob has been dealing with some fairly major transitions for his father, whose health is declining and having to require a great deal of attention despite himself. And other members of the household have been having various intense relationships to their lives, which, you know, from our perspective is, in a spiritual community, is a good thing. And then I kind of look at the news every now and then, and I'll see we're bombing Libya these days. There are ongoing wars that America is participating in. There's incredible polarization in the political climate. And I was reflecting on all of that, and I was reminded of this concept that George Gurdjieff introduced in his master work, All and Everything, Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson, which is this huge allegorical work that kind of is a compendium of many of Gurdjieff's teaching ideas, but they're buried so deeply under allegory that one has to relate to the book in a very different kind of way in order to make sense out of it. But one of the concepts that he introduces in this book is this, what he calls Sulio Annuncius. And Sulio Annuncius is this kind of period of friction. He describes it as a period that arises when certain conditions pertain between the sun and the earth, such that there's sort of a friction of energies that are taking place. And the characteristics of Sulio Annuncius are that the ordinary reactive mind will tend to respond to that energy in anger and reactivity. It will be an occasion for wars, revolutions, for arguments, for frustrations, for all sorts of discordant engagement. But he says that for individuals who are dedicated to actually the pursuit of what he calls objective reason, or what we might call spiritual growth or spiritual development, the period of Sulio Annuncius is actually a very beneficial time. It's a beneficial time because that friction gives us something to work against. It causes automatic factors in ourselves to arise. It causes the things in ourselves that we least want to show to the world to come to the fore, and then we have the opportunity to both be with those things, accept and be present to those things, and also perhaps work on the changing of those things. So a period of Sulio Annuncius, a period of friction, is actually from the Gurdjieffian perspective a bounty time for spiritual practitioners. And yet when you look around, it looks like the world's going to hell in a handbasket. So I bring that up because there's often a narrative that we will tell ourselves, particularly in progressive societies, that the world is going to hell in a handbasket. And I think if you do kind of time-bound studies of people in different periods of time in history, everyone will feel the same thing. And from a different perspective, you might look at it as simply, you know, the world is doing what the world is doing. However, there is energy available right now to move in a different direction. And so what we can do for ourselves and correspondingly for the world around us is to use this friction that we see around us rather than creating a story about how terrible they are or, you know, how bad the world is or how we're just about at the end times and things are falling apart or the economy is going to collapse in the, you know, next 2 weeks when the Republicans shut down the government. You know, instead of identifying with all of that, we can use that same energy, that same kind of friction that comes up, the same frustration we might feel at the latest outrageousness that we read, and turn that into fuel for our spiritual practice. And one of the reason I partly bring that up is one of the leads or one of the comments I made about the purpose of the mystical positivist, which I'll start to describe in a little bit, is that the one of our aims in the show is to have a forum in which we can talk about a different vision of spiritual engagement than is typically discussed. And this is not universal, of course, but there is a tendency for spiritual discussion and depiction of spiritual work in the media to have something of a Deepak Chopra flavor, which is there's a great deal of ebullience and a great deal of positiveness and a great deal of discussion about the great evolving society and that we're all in this great wave of evolution. And whether that's true or not, and I personally tend not to think that it's true, I have a slightly different view of the movement of time, I don't find it a particularly useful thing for spiritual work because it's more like a story. It's kind of like more in the realm of political. It's a story we tell ourselves to elicit certain kinds of feelings, whereas the real meat and potatoes of spiritual work is bringing our attention back to ourselves, bringing our attention back to our bodies as we did, but then from that base, bringing our attention back to the factors that arise in us that tend to be automatic factors triggered by external events. I'm trying to choose my words very precisely because in the end, much of what is the root and cause of our suffering is a sense of out-of-controlness that is arises from the fact that we find the world around us triggering all sorts of reactions in ourselves, and that we find that we're filled with contradictory patterns of response and habit patterns, patterns of mind, patterns of emotion that seem to be there despite ourselves. They seem to be bigger than ourselves. And spiritual practice in the sort of immediate, local, gritty sense is about coming to terms with all of that, learning to confront, not confront in a sense of repression, but to actually stand in the chaos that is our internal selves, but to stand there from a perspective that's rooted in the body and rooted in a dedication to observing and accepting that which we're seeing. So it's gritty because there's a term that some teachers use, I think, I don't know if it's original with Lee Lozowick, but a teacher who recently departed that we know that's been influential in our own school used the term ruthless honesty. And ruthless honesty as a ally in this kind of work is a disposition in ourselves where we're willing to look within, see honestly what is there, and yet, and this is the trick, not judge it. So can you be ruthlessly honest with yourself, but then not fall into a mechanical cycle of internal recrimination? And that's the challenge. So I'm sort of wandering around this vision of spiritual practice, because I want to pull it back to the mystical positivist and speak a little bit about how this project came to be and what we're really trying to achieve with this. But you know, before I start going in that direction, since I've sort of laid out some foundational concepts, if anyone has any questions, this is a good time to ask. Don't all speak at once.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. You made a comment earlier around the traumas that are going on in the world,
mm-hmm.
Libya being one of them.
Japan being another.
That's a natural disaster that influenced a man-made project that went awry.
Mm-hmm.
The natural part, I mean, the devastation is phenomenal. The aerial, the satellite imagery of before and after of coastal areas is phenomenal to see.
Right.
The absolute destruction that happened. You know, what were we thinking? Let's put villages down here, but not thinking that they could be wiped out by such a mm-hmm. force.
Yeah. So the traumas.
The traumas. My mind is a little shy. Richard, and I can't remember. It starts with an H. The party's over.
Heinberg, is it?
Heinberg. Yes. Yeah. Thank you. Talks about. Once we reach peak oil
mm-hmm.
and go into that period where oil's not cheap
right.
to extract it, from a physical standpoint, from a world standpoint, with not even the spiritual, that we're now in a period where I want mine. And that seems to be what Iraq, Afghanistan was just an excuse to go into Iraq. And Libya now, because
mm-hmm.
they're one of the major producers of oil. That's why we're there. We're like trying to cut out our world, because now the Chinese they're trying to get their areas, their influence.
Mm-hmm.
What does that have to? How does that influence what you were a moment ago saying? I'm losing the connection, but
well, let me.
Going?
Yeah, I have a sense of where you're going. Where you're raising a question in that you're actually responding very nicely to a point I raised, because you articulate in a heartfelt way a certain kind of anguish about the picture of the world that we see.
The realities.
Yeah.
How do we view them?
The realities as mediated through the media projection of what is going on. I mean, it's we have to be careful about. What is being constructed for us, and I don't mean that from a conspiratorial sense. It's just that there's a story that's being told, and then there's your immediate life. You know, you're not in Japan right now. You're not in Libya right now. Some people can go over there and immerse themselves in that physical reality, but here we are. There's all these stories being told. There's all these interpretations about the meanings, and what I was describing there, and a point that I am, it's a kind of a difficult point to get across, because I'm not trying to advocate a kind of escapism, but I am advocating that, and the reason I brought up Sulio Annuncius as this sort of physical force is that the majority of human activity in this world tends to be mechanical or unconscious. It can be very sophisticated. It can be very civilized, but the unconsciousness is sort of an effect. You know, why we go to war, why we get into arguments, why we have violence of various sorts, is a product of a kind of an unconscious, very identified life. You use the term "I want mine." Well, yes, it's a kind of a self-absorption or a almost animal survival mechanism. So, given that. I don't construe these events, the wars and things like that, as anything other than natural disasters, akin to what's happening in Japan, and as such, I don't have to react to that angrily. It's not something that causes anguish in a sense. It is something that is simply the way things are.
It's what's going on now.
And my concern, or you know, the fundamental thing of what can I do in response to anything, whether it's what's happening in the world or what's happening across the street when you get the peace protesters and the war veterans, yelling at each other. What can I do? What I can do is to bring my attention back to my center, and I can pull my attention into the reality of my being and the reality of the situation, and to observe rigorously what factors in myself want to arise and tell me this wonderful narrative about, you know, the political troubles of the world, and bring my attention back, and keep bringing my attention back so I can be really present to what is happening. And my sense of this is that that energetic act actually ultimately contributes more to all that's going on than thinking up a storm about it. Or even, you know, getting into some sort of, as Jim would call it, an anger project about protesting and getting all worked up and becoming really active. It's not that there's anything wrong with activism, but when it's unconscious activism, then it's just unconscious behavior. And so the energy that we started this talk with when we brought ourselves back to our bodies was a taste of a kind of different place. We context switched. We brought ourselves back to our bodies. The room quieted down. I remember this quote from Thich Nhat Hanh, you know, I pick up a cup of tea, I stop the world. So stopping the world is something that we can do. It's the work that we can do, and it's a personal work, but it has implications for the world around us. So I tend to think that the kind of compulsive like reading of news events and watching television news and sort of being like a rubbernecker at natural disasters, whether they're political or environmental, is a kind of entertainment, a kind of a perverse entertainment, because we're sort of getting ourselves all worked up. You know, it's no different than many of you who probably have loved ones or parents or something that would yell at the television set, you know, at the nightly news, or maybe you do that. And all of that, though, is a kind of this descent into this dream world that has nothing to do with the real practice of ruthless honesty about what is happening with us. And so bringing the attention in constantly is kind of a simple way of describing spiritual path. And it's not a path of isolationism. This is not intended to be like I'm escaping from the world, or I'm denying the realities of the world. It's simply that the thing that I can do as a being, first and foremost, is to harmonize the energetic state of my body. From that place, if I choose to walk into the world and do things, that will have an influence on others, and the character of the work that it comes from me will also have that quality. But if I go into the world agitated, then I will create more agitation. And so part of the work of this bringing attention back is to work on the foundation of ourself before we worry about solving the problems of the world. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's...
Well, it actually falls in line with practice that I've done actually from about my mid-20s. Of turning off the radio. Mm-hmm. I couldn't stand the commercials. That was influencing my world, you know, but then I took it to the next level, the news. I couldn't handle the news. You know, I mean, I looked at different ways the news was coming at me.
Mm-hmm.
Television was too in your face. The newspapers were better. So that became the way I got my news. You know, and I modulated my exposure to those realities.
Right. Well, so before we move on, I'll just respond to that. that's an interesting thing to do. There's a, from a, and this gets into the empiricism of the mystical positivist, there's another way to work with that kind of stuff, which is, okay, so there's this, whether you call it toxic or whether you call, whatever you call it, you know, there's the news media that's feeding us this wonderful array of narratives that we can consume in our intellectual and emotional centers. So what do you do with that? Well, you describe, I turned it off, so then I kind of reclaim my space. From a point of view of the kind of work that we're talking about, another thing you can do is to cycle that, turn it off for a while, see what that's like, be clear about what's happening within you, what's that like, turn it on again for a while, see how that feels. Well, the point of that is that if there's something about it that causes a reaction, then there's something that's catching you. It's not like the stuff is in and of itself toxic. It's simply that there's something about that stream of impressions that you are chomping into and chewing up, and it's not necessary to do that. In principle, one could be fully immersed in that stream and completely at peace and let it pass through. And simply because you know yourself, you know that the nature of the energy, and you see the arising within yourself of invitations to identify with what's being moved through you, and you can choose consciously not to take the bait. So this is a way of doing an experiment, because all that stuff is energy. It's not good or bad. It's simply just energy that's being presented to us. You know, we often will take these positions of something. I like something, I'll only see that. I don't like something, I'm going to limit for my life. From a empirical, spiritual point of view, it's like anything, any distinction is kind of worthy of attention. So what do? Here is a thing in my life that will cause agitation. Certainly I need to be able to demonstrate to myself that I can turn it off so the habit of indulging in it isn't bigger than me. But at the same time, it's also useful to know whether I can turn it back on and not be washed away. And if I get washed away a little bit, I turn it off again and sort of look at what beach I land on, and then pick myself back up and can do the experiment again. So what I'm talking about is, it's a good metaphor. We don't, this is just like a piece of a way of approaching this work, but it's a good metaphor for the kind of empirical nature of real spiritual practice. You do not make assumptions about the way things are. We do not have to start with a conceptual apparatus that says, this is good, this is bad. We can make direct, immediate experiments from the laboratory that we have, which is our own life, to see what is the effect of this energy, what is the effect of that energy. Now, there are some claims I will make, and I treat these claims as hypotheses, not as absolute truth. A hypothesis means is a claim that it is useful for you to be willing to adopt and then to work with, to see whether or not you can verify or falsify the hypothesis. But a hypothesis is that if we work in this way, if we practice being able to receive energies, whether it's the television or whether it's the unpleasant boss or the difficult relationship or whatever, if we practice opening ourselves to those energies, maybe gradually at first, maybe, depending on your character, you jump in like you jump into the deep end of a pool, but if you practice opening yourself to these energies, then you can see what about your constitution reacts mechanically to their presence and begin to gather information or data about the reactive unconscious habit patterns that one has. And in that process, begin to cultivate a kind of a presence or a kind of perspective that is outside of those contractive, deep, dark, unconscious patterns that tend to be the factors that guide most of our experience when we're not actively paying attention. So what you're describing, and what we're going back and forth with, turning the radio off and turning it back on is an important example, because this work is not about isolating ourselves from that which is uncomfortable. This work is really more about moving towards that which is uncomfortable, you know, ideally in the context of a community of fellow practitioners that can help, you know, meter how far you go, you know, I mean, how quickly you go. But typically our own internal states will only allow us to go as fast as we're willing to go. But the direction is always towards more of what we find uncomfortable or what we find either agitating, not because we're trying to torture ourselves, but because we're trying to understand underneath all of that why these things arise. Because the claim, again, the hypothesis is that there is a place we can be, there is a relationship we can be with our bodies, our hearts, and our minds that is completely at peace with the way things are, or completely at peace with the universe as it is. And it doesn't mean that we're passive. It simply means that the way we engage is more as a dance. We engage with our life as a dance, or we engage with our life as a conversation. We can act. We can even be idealistic and act in ways that, from external purposes, look like they're trying to change the world. But it's the internal place that we act from is a place of complete acceptance. And that's sort of the nature, this is a hypothesis. I call this a hypothesis because it's a pretty story, and it's completely useless unless one tries to make it real for themselves. And making it real for oneself requires testing it against the real conditions of one's life. So going back to this whole idea of solio enuncius, all that really means is that it's a time of marked friction where there's a much greater array of things to annoy us so that we can test in ourselves why certain patterns of energy, when they come into us, create these reactive patterns. And then to ultimately grow bigger than those patterns so that we don't have to react. Doesn't mean that it may not be appropriate to allow anger to move through us, because there are certain times where anger is very appropriate for what a situation needs. But we don't want to be owned by the anger. We want to simply use the anger as a tool. Likewise, loving response, openness, gentleness. You know, there's ways that we can consciously respond to situations that are very, very human and deeply human, but we don't want to be in a rut. We want to be able to explore the full range of what's available as being an embodied person. So, the radio show, I sort of got sidetracked here, but I was talking about a lot of the media depictions of spiritual work don't really try to capture what we're talking about here. You get it in some cases, but often what happens is that media depictions of spiritual teachers or spiritual groups are often through the eyes of people who actually don't engage in spiritual practice. They may be fans, but they're not really like long-term practitioners. There are definitely examples to the contrary, so I don't mean to overgeneralize, but my observation has been that there's a kind of, particularly in Northern California, a trendiness about spiritual practice in the media, and it's kind of a cool thing to do, and it's interesting, and we're saving the world, and everyone's singing and smiling, and you know, they're having a good time, and it's really, really great. And I wanted to bring a different perspective to the discourse and really focus on long-term practitioners and teachers, and to talk to them about topics of real, you know, sort of real distinctions and real difficult questions that confront spiritual practitioners, and some of the real differences between teachings. Like, we had one guy on the show at one point who, and we're nice about it. I mean, this isn't confrontative or like shock radio or anything like this. It's because we really are trying to achieve conversations. But we had one guy on who had this was sort of backstory that we knew, and it didn't come out explicitly in the interview, but we knew that he had experience with a teacher in a community that had the teacher's sense becomes fairly controversial as someone who, quote unquote, you know, abused members of the community or was you know, really engaging in sort of questionable acts, you know, that where the story is, you know, it's more of a narcissistic personality as opposed to an enlightened personality that's leading this community. And so the guy who had been a part of that reality had a very strong sense or vision of what spiritual practice was, and that really was in the model of the spiritual friend, and like a spiritual teacher is a spiritual friend and a support, and it's a very nice relationship. And we were engaging in the conversation about that. It was actually very interesting because Rob and I were doing the interview, and we were certainly our tradition in our work with our own teachers and our work with students isn't always nice, you know, and sometimes it's actually can be very shocking. And it's not that that's like a good thing in and of itself. It's just that our observation has been, and my own personal observation and what my own process was in spiritual practice, was that there were times where strong force had to be applied to help shift me from a particular habit of mind or habit of heart that I might have been engaged in. And that if it was always sort of a nice conversation, that kind of intensity wouldn't necessarily have been achieved. Now, I'm not going to, you know, this could be a stylistic difference, or it could be a fundamental difference. I personally think it's a fundamental difference. But my point in with the radio show is that we were having a real conversation about this topic, and it was actually very interesting because there was like this energy behind it. Like there was this great resistance in the guest in terms of when we would describe the perspective I just offered about the kind of necessity of forcefulness. But it was a useful discussion, because I think it was a discussion that's relevant for dedicated spiritual practitioners. It is a real issue, and it's always an issue, because one ultimately has to decide for oneself, you know, what are the right conditions for one, and take responsibility for that. But it's a, when you look at what it takes to transform unconscious habit patterns, my own personal observation, both in myself and in people that I see in our own and other spiritual communities, is that sometimes those habit patterns are very, very, very deeply rooted, and they do not shift easily. And the mind is remarkably creative in finding subtle ways to avoid actually changing. It's actually beautiful in its ability to avoid actual fundamental change. And what does fundamental change mean? Well, fundamental change is a shift in identity. It's a shift in where we locate our sense of self. There's a sense in the very bedrock of what we operate as ourselves. And that's not really, you know, it's great to read about that. It's great to read about, you know, gurus who are, you know, at age 16 suddenly, you know, go into a coma and wake up enlightened and stuff like that. But for most ordinary schmucks, certainly like me, that's not really a small thing we're talking about. Even the desire to do that is rare in itself, but the actual willingness to subject oneself to the kind of force necessary to have that kind of change, or to cultivate that kind of change, is rarer still. That's my own perspective on that. You have a question?
Actually, it's more like I'd like to sit with that for a second. It's so interesting. What came to me was the habituated self, this self to go to out of habit, and that's not the self. The self is not habituated at all.
Yeah.
So just it's just the role of patterns, the role of habit, and that actually the act of getting rid of habit and getting rid of patterns is what consciousness is.
I'm with you a little bit. Let me work with that, because it's a good lead-in into what I mean by mystical positivism. So, why the mystical positivist? What does that mean? The and Jim probably can help me with this because he's actually has been a professional philosopher. But my understanding of positivism in philosophy is a belief in what you might call a scientific methodology, a belief in a kind of the ability to make assertions and falsify assertions, the belief in empiricism is a grounds for discovering the nature of whatever the subject has to be. And then there's lots of flavors of positivism. The most but positivism as a core is sort of more like a scientific outlook. It's but not scientific in the sense of studying physics and atoms and protons and things like that, but more like an acceptance at a axiomatic level that logical reasoning is an acceptable tool for a certain kind of exploration of the world. Okay, and so the most notorious form of positivism is called logical positivism. And logical positivism, I'm not even sure why the logical gets on there, how this got grouped, but the logical positivist movement was really dominated by materialists who took the scientific language and then drew an additional conclusion, which was that the only thing that's fundamentally real is matter, matter and energy and the laws of physics and the laws of nature, and things like consciousness and things like self are epiphenomena that are, you know, complex arisings that have in their ground a material basis. And consequently, things like ideas of God or things like, you know, metaphysical ideas are completely right out. They're completely suspect because they're not provable, for one. That's really the critique. They're not provable. You know, I can say what I like about God, but I cannot subject God to an experiment. That's the claim, and that's logical positivism. So then the other thing to consider is, okay, well, what does mysticism mean? And mysticism is interesting, and there's actually, you know, you can look in things like Wikipedia and you know, to get the Cliff Notes version of all this stuff, and it's, I find it useful for this kind of discourse. You know, mysticism is about individuals directly engaging with the nature of their selves. And mysticism, you know, to understand mysticism, mysticism is not religion. There are mystical traditions within religions, and very typically, mystical traditions within religions are persecuted because the mystical perspective is that I have everything I need here and now in order to go deep. I have everything I need to realize self. I have everything I need to realize communion with God. So the mystical perspective is that accepts a certain metaphysical reality of God being self as fundamental realities, but the key point is that as a mystic, the work is ultimately personal, and the work is ultimately available to everybody, and it does not need to be mediated through a religious structure or hierarchy. So this is why the mystical tradition in Islam, the Sufis, get persecuted. The mystical traditions within Christianity often get persecuted, although you know, Saint Francis was, I think, fairly adept politically, so that he cultivated a mystical tradition but did not challenge the hierarchy, and so he was more successful in creating a mystical tradition within the structure of the church. But even in Hinduism, you'll see more mystical forms than other forms that tend to be more religious, or in Buddhism as well. I mean, you can see this kind of sense. I'd say Buddhism tends to have more of a sensibility of mysticism in general, but that's not even that's an overly general statement if you start to look at the differences in different schools of Buddhism. So mysticism has this sense of that there is a spiritual reality to our lives and we can just discover it ourselves. So what does mystical positivism mean? I put those together. It may just be unique to my character because I had a very strongly, you know, scientific education, but I always had a sensibility as a mystic as well. So I've personally been described at various times as a scientific mystic. And so for me, mystical positivism is the natural bringing together of these things, which is that my contention is that it is possible to apply reasoned approach, apply an empirical approach to the question of deepening one's mystical experience. I was just giving you a flavor of that a little bit earlier. The flavor I was giving you was that it is possible, you know, to, like an example that you gave, so an experiment would be, okay, here's the source of energy, it creates a reaction in me, I turn it off, things change. Okay, well that's interesting, that's a data point, now I turn it on again, what happens? And then maybe I do that over and over again and see if there's a change. If I apply my attention in a certain way through a process of self-observation and do this rigorously over and over again, I should be able, from a perspective of awareness, see changes. Now, the mystical positivism part of it is that ultimately the laboratory is yourself. Ultimately, you are the journal. Ultimately, you are the board that judges whether your experiments are correct or not. Because as much as you can tell other people, as soon as you go out and other, you're beginning to mediate your direct experience. So mystical positivism tries to start with the premise that there's only one fact that you know, and that's the fact of your awareness. That's the only fact that you know. That's the starting point. That is the seed of truth. Everything else is an inference from that. The sense of identity in a body, my feelings of my body's, the conceptualization I have, even the raw sensations that I feel, and the experience of the self, the experience of the now I feel, are constructs. Those things ultimately are constructs. So they're not as fundamental as this pure sense of attention or this sense of beingness that is the root of everything. So to Michael's point, you know, and this is the tie-in to what you were saying, is that yes, that is the starting point. And then the positivism part of mystical positivism is being scrupulously clear in your awareness at each step that what you see, you know, my hand, my body, my life, my friends, you know, all of these things are now further and further away from that pure reality, and that's not a bad or good thing. It's simply that I have to be aware of that to know that I have less and less ability to make absolute truth claims about that world that I see. So the one truth claim I can make is the raw fact of my existence. So we start there. Everything else we have to sort of test, question, relate to, you know, and in a sense what you're saying, what Michael, I heard you say, was that, you know, one of the functions is to strip away the words, to strip away the emotional reactivity, to strip away all of the habitual responses that we have to events in our lives, to open ourselves up to a way of being where we can accept what is. Now, that's phase one, and here's where, again, I get into the kind of grittiness, and where one of these days I'll get some non-dualists on our show, and then we'll have some fun, which is that there's the kind of popular non-dualism ideas now, that everything is one, and you know, they would hear what I just said and say, yes, that's it, everything is consciousness. To me, that's way too simplistic, because that already is a interpretation, or that's kind of a conceptualization or a frame that's being put on this raw, pure experience that we're talking about. So the words that I would use to describe it is that when you find and cultivate connectivity to this pure fact of our existence and begin to build that awareness and create a kind of spaciousness or presence in our lives that is beyond the interpretations, the thoughts, the reactive emotions, and the even the compulsive body postures. When we can move beyond that, there's an opportunity for an engagement with the diversity of life that is equally profound as the engagement with the fact or reality or hypothesis that everything also is the same as this self that we experience. So what I'm saying is that the non-dual perspective is nice in one sense, in that we can find, as we turn our attention towards the raw fact of our awareness, it may be that it's certainly a compelling picture that may be God. That may be what you find within, at the deepest core, stripped away of all the clothing. That may be God. And we may have direct access to God in that sense. And that may be the same God that's in everyone. But at the same time, there's this fabulous diversity that we find ourselves in, and that also is a manifestation of the absolute. And so one isn't senior to the other. They both coexist, and we don't have to create a kind of a distinction between them. We don't have to say that everything is consciousness, because sometimes everything isn't consciousness. Sometimes the moment of our lives require that we act as though we're different, as we act as though there's other, as we act as though there are separate things in the world. If I acted as though everything was consciousness, truly acted in that way in certain contexts, like in my workplace, it might not work. It might not work so well. I mean, I don't want to be glib, because it's possible that I'm fooling myself, and I have to be aware of that possibility, that this could be a very sophisticated argument to justify a kind of a withhold on my part and a cowardice about truly letting go in a certain way in, like, my work environment. And that if I were to do that, I might jump off the cliff and find a kind of freedom that I haven't tasted. So I have to be willing to allow that to be the case. At the same time, it may be the case that playing the role that it sort of appears and playing it perfectly without identifying with it, without having my sense of identity contingent on the outcome of that situation, might be a different kind of freedom. It may be a kind of a freedom in which I can inhabit the separate existence, or the sort of the colorful, you know, mind-body construct that I find myself in fully, and engage with life in a loving, accepting way. It doesn't mean necessarily being nice, but simply being responsive and present to it without having it have to be any other way than it is. And that is a kind of a freedom that's a different kind of freedom. And that's another possible way to discover and way to engage with life that is worthy of exploration. Yeah?
The sense of identity you have, is that use your interactions with the world around you and to help form that, or is this strictly an interior process?
Are you saying that the sense of identity that I was referring to as the root, or are you saying that just a sense of identity of, like, what constitutes our sense of identity?
I didn't distinguish when I formulated the question. My question wasn't specific to that level. I was using it in the same sense that you just used it in a sense a couple of sentences back. But I may not have apprehended fully how you were using it then.
Let me kind of clarify that term. So there's a kind of a way we relate to identity, which is we each have a sense of identity, and it's located somewhere. And where that identity is a subject of exploration by ourselves in spiritual practice. I think in the Don Juan Castaneda's material, there was a nice term called the assemblage point. And so it's sort of, you can think of that as this location. In the Gurdjieff work, it's like we have these multiple centers, and there's these separate eyes in these centers, and we tend to hang out in a certain reliable cluster of eyes, and that composes our what they call the chief feature. So we have a kind of a fundamental set of habit patterns in our organism by which we respond to the world, and our sense, our ordinary psychological sense, you know, as you start down the path of this kind of work, is our, you know, our feeling of what is, the sort of feeling level of the thoughts that maintain that feeling and the sort of body postures that reinforce that feeling are our identity. Now, that identity can shift. That identity can shift. My mystical positivist claim is that, which is a working hypothesis, is that there is available a fundamental identity that is, you know, when people refer to self-realization, that's the discovery of what the fundamental root identity of being is, stripped away of all contingency. That's the idea, that's the thesis. But to get there requires that one work with what one's got and begin to observe oneself, to understand and sort of begin really surgically peel back what the construction of our working identity is.
Thank you. And in the last little bit, I more clearly understand where you are coming from and what my question needs to be. And the essential identity, is it, my question still goes back to, when you strip away, you mentioned stripping away reference, I think.
Yeah, or stripping away definition, or stripping away, you might call it clinging as well. There's different, it has different vocabularies depending on what center you're talking about, and certainly in the way that we talk about these things.
I'm kind of wondering, I guess, fundamentally, what the frame of reference is, how you could describe what the frame of reference is within which you define the aspects of your identity.
Would you say work?
I said work.
Yeah, I mean that's one way of.
I was thinking something more essential.
Well, I guess to me it's like the boundaries of it. It's hard to see, so it's hard to talk about. The boundaries of it can be just explored by the things that you have to defend against. So a sense of identity, a reflexive sense of identity, is if someone says something to hurt you, mm-hmm. and you're hurt. Well, there is the operation of an identification, but it's hard because we are in it. You know, and this is one of the challenges. In fact, on the last weekend on our show, we were talking about some neurobiological theories of self, and they had this great metaphor of that the self is transparent to us. It's wholly constructed, but it's completely transparent. So you can't see the operation of the self, or in this case, identity. We can't see the operation of identity. We can only start to observe it a little bit indirectly, and that again is the function of self-observation: is to empirically begin to gather data in a different part of ourselves, let's say, or from a different perspective, mm-hmm. that informs us on the operating nature of our identity. Because we're in it, so it's transparent, but you certainly know, as I said, you get hurt, mm-hmm. you react. If I go to work, to use your example about work, and I'm, you know, constantly kind of worried about what my boss is going to think, or, you know, I'm, you know, whatever the power dynamic happens to be, you know, there's another kind of functioning identity.
Okay. So it sounds to me like this identity that you're talking about, in this sense, is to me a thing that is bounded by, provoked by interacting with the world.
That is.
And formed in response to it.
Yes, that aspect of identity I would agree with.
Is there a more essential identity that you feel incarnates in the life and is untouched by the circumstances of the life and the experiences of the being in the life?
Okay, that's a great laboratory question.
Okay.
So I, whether I claim something or not, all I can possibly claim for you is a hypothesis to work with. And what the contours of what you just described actually are, maybe exactly what you said that you might find if you descend into a level of being in your personal work that allows you to see directly or have a sense of seeing directly what that is, you may ultimately use different words to describe that. Because some of what you know, some of the metaphors of untouched, you know, are words that sort of create a sense of opposition or separation, which I don't think something necessarily has to be untouched, but it doesn't necessarily have to be. There could be a sense of self or an essential self that is not reactive or does not have to react, is not compelled to react to energetic flux through our various vehicles of perception. Mm-hmm. And that would be something to explore. To me, that's a worthy question. And that is a question a mystic would explore. And my perspective as a mystical positivist is that there is methodologies that one can employ along with certain root values like ruthless honesty to deepen with that question.
It's almost like we're skipping ahead to the archaeology.
we may be getting to the archaeology itself. That'll be part two. Yeah.
What if, from as long as you can remember, the earliest childhood, you have felt an inner observer who isn't attached to what's going on, but just simply observing it, not judging it. And all your life you have had this.
You talking about me? Or
no, I'm talking about me.
Yeah. So one, yeah, in this case, you have felt that.
I have felt that. I still feel that. Mm-hmm. I've always felt that. And at times I have judged it. I have felt, well, you're cold. You're not responding to the outside world the way you should. But I don't do that anymore. I recognize that as being a very intrinsic part of what I would call myself.
Mm-hmm. And that's worthy of exploration. You know, the from a mystical positivist perspective, that's certainly interesting. And then the question is, can you test, you know, or go deeper with what is that? What is that? You know, instead of judging it, which it sounds like you did at one time.
Yeah,
But more to put more attention, in a sense, there's this observing self, so now can you put more attention on the observing self? Is it really non-judgmental, or is there some character of judgment in its operation? You know, those are interesting questions. I'm not asserting that it's one way or the other, but I'm simply saying that from a perspective of a mystical positivist, everything's on the table. And a mystical positivist resists the temptation to fix their state of development with, a definition, because any definition we have is inevitably going to be incomplete.
You asked if I were talking about you.
Mm-hmm.
Have you had that same?
Well, my experience
from earliest childhood.
I wouldn't characterize it that way. There have been moments that I can point to in my childhood where there were clear points at which my normal functioning of attention on the outside world was shifted. I certainly was self-reflective and internal, and so I would think about my, I was imaginative, my attention would go into myself, and I was interested in, you know, UFOs and ghosts and, you know, even when I was a little kid and stuff like that. So there was always this kind of fascination with the occult and the beyond. But none of that is necessarily the that's still very formal. It's my relationship to myself is still mediated through a lot of thinking about things and thinking about ideas and how and my feelings were these things that happened to me, and then my thoughts would react accordingly, and then my reaction to my thoughts would engender more feelings. You know, I was like a normal person, and in that sense, I don't think I was special. The specialness, if anything, was there's a, for people who want to keep going deeper in this kind of direction, that's unusual just statistically. So I had in the end for me, what was different for me was nothing else out there satisfied me. So there was nothing else that I could find meaning of, whether it was finding the right physics curriculum or the, you know, the right sexual relationship or the right course of study or whatever, or the right job. There was nothing out there that could satisfy, and I had in my college years enough small world experience of sort of being a big fish in a small pond, you know, to even taste that fame was not in the end something that was a necessity that I had to have, you know. So it was like I had enough experiences to find that nothing else was like doing it for me, and so I had to, it was like a necessity for me to reach out for something, not knowing what it was I was reaching out for. So there was a moment for me of literally jumping off the cliff in my life to say, I've got to do something different. That's unusual, because most people typically will find that they, you know, they find something that's relatively satisfying, or they settle for something, and these are they may even find these kinds of questions interesting, but their life doesn't become organized around those that inquiry. Yeah.
At the risk of getting into the word games.
That's okay. We're here to
word games.
We're here to dissect them.
I was confused, surprised when you were talking about non-dualism, and I guess I don't see a difference in what you're saying and non-dualism. In that,
well,
you know, we're all these incredible facets of this one gem, and we're all, you know, we look incredibly different, da 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 da. But
yeah, my distinction or my quibble with non-dualism is a tactical quibble rather than a strategic quibble, if you will, if I can use some business language, which always annoys Rob. So.
Not always.
Okay. So when I say I'm in a strategic agreement with that, it's like, sure, everything's consciousness. I can say that, and I can those words can mean something for me and actually even be a touchstone for going back to kind of a reminder of not to be identified. The tactical issue I have is that I think this is more true for Western non-dualists than it is for people in Eastern non-dual traditions, because people in Eastern non-dual traditions have a far more devotional relationship to the practice. But for Westerners, there tends to be, there's often, it's not always obviously, but there's often a an excitation around the ideas and a sort of a stopping, like once you've got the idea that everything's consciousness, it's like you get this kind of interesting discourse where you try to have any sort of real conversation with someone, it's like, oh, is everything's consciousness? Or like we had a speaker here, a non-dualist who's not I would say not a particularly good one, but
I think the good ones would
but you know, and every time I would try to ask a question, it's like, well, just look over there, you know, just see it, just, you know, it was like a almost seamless intellectual Mobius strip where you know, basically it was one-sided and it was a complete circle, and you couldn't get off it. You know, it's like you just could not get off it. In a topological sense, it was like this closed, this trap. And so I see that happen with people who engage with those kinds of ideas.
It's a pitfall.
Yeah. So the question I have for people in that, is, you know, how is the non-dual understanding reflected in your engagement from a heart level? Mm-hmm. How is the non-dual understanding engaged in your relation at a body level? That's where you can see, you know, whether or not, you know, someone has sort of stuck it up here and the energy is kind of stuck and it's not moving. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons why I think it's a far more profound tradition in the Indian traditions, because there's a operating, whether it's an understanding or if it just happens to be the case, there's an operational engagement at the heart level through the devotional practice. Mm-hmm. So that even, you know, Nisargadatta Maharaj would do pujas and had a devotional relationship to his teacher and did what his teacher said as a good disciple, did exactly what his teacher said and only what his teacher said, and that was the basis on which he awakened. It was not on the basis of thinking this great thought over and over and again.
Which you can if you try.
Well, I mean,
and why try?
You can certainly succeed in thinking the thought over and over again.
Yeah,
but what you'll succeed in doing is thinking the thought over and over again,
right.
Which again gets back to, from a mystical positivist perspective, the ruthless honesty comes in and trying to simply be aware of one doing that, and being aware of the degree to which one settles for any kind of answer in terms of a self-referential description about wherever one is. It's better to continue the experiment. And if you get an answer, like a good scientist, you know, if you look at the history of science, what science does is they don't do an experiment and then they stop. They do an experiment, they get an answer, and then they start thinking about the next experiment to either falsify the answer or to establish a new kind of ground of what may be the case. Yeah, it's never ending. Similarly to, you know, other disciplines of mind, you know, like mathematics, there will always be this kind of ongoing elaboration of conceptual structures, and then exploration of the consequences of those things, and then suddenly, you know, new structures are added, and it goes on and on. But similarly for us, in terms of our relationship to our practice, it's a never-ending inquiry, just like learning a musical instrument is a never-ending deepening of a relationship in moving energy and allowing energy to express through you. And this is the same way in which our spiritual practice can be engaged in. And so from a, you know, the mystical positivist perspective is one that says you vigilantly look for places in which you are settling for accepting an idea or even a feeling state for the way things are. And then make that a subject of inquiry, because then you can begin to discover whether it's something that is fundamental or something that is actually just adopted and contingent.
Well, sometimes I think just the doing of inquiry kind of brings the mind in.
You can. I mean, it depends on how one engages in it, but again, you know. And the issue then is how serious one is about this kind of transformation. You know, people who are serious are willing to engage in a disciple relationship with teachers, because it's not that they're giving up their power. It's like they're allowing at least for a well-defined context, they are allowing factors other than their own internal factors to be the cause of activity, and then looking at the friction that arises, because that friction will then be information about places where we may be stuck or we can't move. I mentioned Denise Berry, the Aikido instructor and sensei, she gave a talk here at Many Rivers last week, and she was using all these great analogies about, you know, Aikido is about energy coming to you, and how do you respond? How do you face the energy? So in a teaching context, like with in a teacher-student relationship, often if it's got a lot of juice around it, there's energy that may be being thrown at one. There's emotional Aikido going on, in which if one is not flexible, one won't fall right, or one won't roll right, and be able to stand back up. And so there's work on exploring that kind of flexibility. And that tends
very
to be... Yeah, it's very tricky. It's also very difficult, because when we talk about identity, a lot of our identity is located in our feeling space. You know, that tends to be where people... We can have ideas about ourselves, but it's when you push the habits of feeling, push the habits of pride and things like that, that then you discover in real terms, real very energetic terms, oh, here's where my identity is. There it is. Very clear then. And so putting yourself in a context where that gets clarified is not everyone's cup of tea, believe me. But it's an indication of how serious these kinds of questions are. And and I'm not trying to paint a picture that it's always, it's universally the same for everybody, because everybody brings a different set of conditions and issues to any sort of process of spiritual inquiry. But if it's the most important thing for us, then everything else in our life is behind it or secondary to it. And it's from there that there's the possibility of foundational shifting of this identity into the exploration of maybe a lesser and lesser constrained or lesser and lesser defined identity. And that's, as I said, that's an ongoing exploration.
Yeah. I'm not sure if this connects anymore, but what came to me a little while ago was trying to find using the conceptual mind to kind of discover non-conceptuality, or using a wet towel to try drying yourself.
Well, yeah, I'd say that
it's mutually exclusive.
Yeah, I mean, I want to respond to that, because when I speak about the empirical method, I don't actually think of that as conceptual. It can be articulated conceptually, and it typically is articulated conceptually. But empirical for me is a willingness to put myself into a situation, being aware that I am doing it from a sense of openness to see what I can find out about myself, and observing the results. And if I observe from an objective place, there will attain to me a kind of an awareness or a kind of understanding. Gurdjieff used to call it the crystallization of data. There will be a lived experience that becomes part of my being, and that does not have to be articulated conceptually. That is actually foundational in this identity that we're talking about. So in that sense, the empirical method is not, it's more of a operating value that you continue to explore. It's sort of like the will to test, or the will to open, is kind of like the pure scientific impulse. It's like, I want to open myself, I want to discover more. I do not want to accept that I'm done. I want to continue to unfold. And that is like the core non-conceptual scientific impulse that moves the mystical positivist practitioner forward. And any domain, whether it's the physical domain, taking up, Aikido, at an advanced age, or the emotional domain, which is quote-unquote dangerous engagement with others in a sense that may be emotionally dangerous because we might not be in control of the situation, that may be another way. The inquiry at the conceptual level can be a valid way to move through a certain kind of conditioning. But all of these, from our perspective, are open areas or grounds for this kind of ongoing exploration.
I love that crystallization of data.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah, Gurdjieff's, his book, is just, that's why I say it's kind of like this long allegory, because there's these wonderful gems that are very precise language for something that when you read it and then begin to reflect on engaging in that process, you find out that the language is actually beautifully precise. But it's still an allegory. It's not you don't want to lose sight of the allegorical nature of it. So this radio show, just to get, going back to the mundane, what time is it? Is it
5 of 9.
Oh, okay. So the radio show is a vehicle in which we take like the perspective that I've been describing, but then we use that to talk to other practitioners. And the interesting thing for me about it is to engage in dialogue, but to try to engage in dialogue where I want to find out how other people think about these questions from the point of view of their practice. And that helps me just in terms of how I represent or how I relate to this metaphor of the mystical positivist. But I think it also makes for interesting dialogue with teachers, and interesting things come out of it. We end up having these nice conversations where we get to spiritual practical issues that often folks don't get to in their normal, certainly not when they're interviewed, because, as I said, you know, most people are just trying to find out about the raw elements of someone's practice. And we're trying to kind of get into more deeper level issues about how do you practice? You know, what are you trying to do? What are the assumptions, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. How are you using the word positivist? Because, I mean, it sounds like you're opening to all of it and not having to put a positive spin on things.
Well, so that's why positivist is... A reason I like the term mystical positivist is if you don't know the technical meaning of it, it sounds like it's I'm saying, yeah, mysticism. But the technical term actually of positivism has a very specific philosophical meaning, which is this empirical approach. It is the
science.
Yeah, it's sort of the outline of the scientific method in which that there is the possibility that statements can be made, they can be tested, they can be falsified, or they can be verified, and that is how you progress with the deepening of knowledge in whatever field. Now, there's, you know, I think that Rob was doing some research on this. There was actually once a Church of Positivism, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of the term is, there's all sorts of uses of the term positivist, and but it still has a very specific kind of philosophical meaning. And so my conjoining of the two is, at one level, it's a very specific statement that I've been articulating. At another level, it sounds good, there's nothing like a catchy phrase, too.
So I could see how it could be misinterpreted.
Yeah, but the misinterpretation is great. You know, it's like people going, huh? I guess it's possible that people didn't come to the talk tonight because they thought this was going to be like a rah-rah session.
It's really another way of saying the scientific mystic, which is what you said you've been called.
Yeah, and
you see mysticism, you look at it, inquire in a scientific way, but in a mystical realm, so to speak.
Yeah, and I've been influenced in my practice by the fourth way tradition, which is kind of the language or a lot of the metaphors that we use in our own work, and that was kind of created as a scientific mysticism, if you will. It builds on the principle of verifiability, except no conclusion without testing it in your own experience. Other traditions say this in different ways, but the fourth way was very explicit about trying to build that because they were trying to. Gurdjieff was actually trying to appeal to a certain community of European intellectuals in the early part of the 20th century. So it's like that was the dominant mindset of people at that time, scientism. So to have a spiritual discipline and a spiritual tradition that was grounded in a scientific language was very appealing. It's not a necessary thing, but it's certainly the methodologies have the spark of a kind of an empirical approach to self-study, and it's certainly resonant for me. Now, that's partly because of my own history, my peculiar history of science education and spiritual practice makes it very well-suited, but it doesn't. But I also think it's useful as a general metaphor to ask questions about how we practice and challenge ourselves about where do we... When do we stop? When does our practice stop and we just buy an assumption about ourselves or buy either, whether it's a limitation or it's a inflated claim or whatever, when does the practice stop? When do we stop trying to open for more? When do we stop testing, asking, inquiring?
I guess a core question in there is, is it possible through our own efforts to get to will it be our own efforts that will lead us
that's a good question. My experience has been that I guess like any good question, the answer is yes and no. Yes, in the sense that in the end it can only be your efforts that allow you to deepen your relationship to the true nature of yourself and the true nature of your being. It can only be your efforts. There's no one else who can do it for you. At the same time, the universe is filled with help. And so one aspect of the effort that people generally have to make, I certainly had to make, was to adopt a willingness to accept help from the universe in whatever form that took.
It's an intention.
Right. And so it's still my effort, but I also can get help. You know, there's a book that a woman, Marianna Kaplan, wrote called Conscious Discipleship, and that kind of, that title and the book itself captures that kind of, you know, it's my effort, you know, it's my responsibility, but I am also engaging in a discipleship relationship with a teacher, which from ordinary standards looks like a kind of a very strange power dynamic, you know, whose purposes don't make any sense, and I should say from Western standards. I mean, other cultures have much deeper understanding of that kind of relationship. But basically, it's still our responsibility. It's still our effort.
But where does that come from?
Where does what come from?
Our effort.
Good question. I mean, that is a useful question to ask. I should mention here, when I talk about these questions too, is that the relationship of this kind of practice to question is that questions are guides. Questions are sort of like antenna for moving our experience along. They're not these closed form things where the question has an answer. You know, the question you just asked of, you know, where does my effort come from, is an ongoing meditation that would be useful to ask yourself as often as you can remember, because the answer may be different from time to time. You know, there may be an effort that comes up that's completely a reactive psychological state to some perception of something that's going to happen to you if you don't make the effort. Or there may be you may discover a genuine, unqualified movement in yourself that just brings you forward, sort of almost like a magnetism that has the need, the inherent need to deepen in this way. Right. So again, you know, it's a good question to ask, but it's not a one that has a simple answer. It's more like that's been known in a tradition that was a teacher that we know called the centrum of gravity question, which is basically you hold the question and let the question kind of move with the question so that you can see what the question has to reveal at a non-conceptual level, even though the question may be framed as conceptually. It's an antenna for a non-conceptual kind of tuning into one's experience in the world. So, the radio show. The Cal's LP radio. How many people know about Cal's? How many people don't? Okay, so do you live in the area?
Mm-hmm.
So Cal's is an Occidental community radio station. It's a low power station, which means it has a 10-mile broadcast radius.
Oh, excellent.
But it has a live internet feed, which is useful right now because the last set of rainstorms knocked their antenna, so now it probably has about a 10-foot broadcast radius. But you can still listen to it live on the internet if you have access to a computer. And I have a bunch of schedules here and some information if you're interested in becoming involved either as a supporter or, you know, there's programming slots come available if you're interested in doing radio shows. But we started this project in December. We've done 15 shows so far. I post all the shows on the internet. So there's a blog site that has recordings of the shows, so people can go see them after the fact and
hear them.
Thank you. And as being on the internet, it has worldwide appeal. In fact, one of our shows, the interview with Red Hawk, who wrote the book Self Observation, was translated by someone. They did a transcript and translated it into Spanish in Argentina for a blog. And so now, yeah, I'm getting hits in South America for the website. So that's pretty cool. And we do know that at least some of our friends in Mauritius listen to it. And I've seen hits from as far away as Korea and Israel and... I think I even got one in Russia. I don't know if anyone spends any time on the site, but at least people are seeing it. But we're just building up. We're just trying to put a lot of content there and create a library of interesting material that will be available for folks. So the show runs live from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. on Saturdays. And while I'm away, tomorrow I'm flying off to Israel for business, and Rob is going to do the show this weekend. And our guest will be Dr. Tin Tin. Oh. So some of you know, she's spoken in this store before. And then the following week we'll have Danielle Tarano. Did I say that right this time? Yeah, good. he's the Roshi at the Clouds and Rock Zendo.
Rocks and Clouds.
Almost.
Three blocks from here.
And that should be he'll be fun for us to interview because he has a lot of experience in the fourth way tradition before he got into Zen. So he actually it'll be interesting for me to talk about some of the languaging about these about practice. So there are bumper stickers here. Yeah, and I should also mention that we have a also Tayu.
I don't think so.
Tayu has a study group that meets in this space every Tuesday evening at 7:30, where the group explores the practices of self-observation and the kind of work that we've been talking about.
Called Refuge of Presence Practice Group.
Is,
there
right.
Is that open to drop-ins?
Yes, it's open to drop-ins. It's open, you know, there's a number
of
people who have been...
There's brochures right near the door that you can take with you about that.
Right, there's people who have been engaged in the study for a while. When new people show up, we talk about the basic practice and make it... so people can drop in too if they haven't been exposed to this material. And anything else? I think that's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.